Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, thanks for tuning into the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. I've got a pretty controversial topic for you this evening, at least if any of the television shows that I have appeared on are any indication. It's pretty controversial even today. The topic is, should we sell sex? Actually, the full title was the label that they used when I spoke at Yale University in February. Sex sells, but should we sell sex? It's a good question. It's a really good question. And joining me tonight is a law student by the name of Lawrence Cohen, and he comes from, and I'm going to probably butcher the name of this university, but Quinnipiac University, is that right?
That's correct.
Welcome to the show, Lawrence. Thanks for joining me tonight to have this very controversial discussion. I have to tell you this right off the bat, I really admire your courage because a lot of people don't want to take on the topic.
Well, I just think it's an interesting topic, and it's a topic that's worth discussing. You know, my perspective is that of a law student, and I see it as an intellectual exercise.
Well, awesome. I love intellectual exercises, and I'm going to assume most of my listeners do too.
Great.
You know, it's just to get the ball rolling here, it's amazing how allergic people are just to sex. When you start talking about selling it, it's even another thing. But two things. I was watching Oprah Winfrey today. I had to because sexologist Laura Berman was on there talking about how you should talk about sex to your kids. And it just, for me, is such a reality check. I guess I don't realize how incredibly shut down the rest of the world is around sex because, you know, I'm dealing with the topic all the time. But sure. These mothers of these children were just seemed completely baffled on how to have a conversation about sex. And a lot of the kids aren't shut down yet. It's like they're fully alive, you know. This one little girl, she's 10 years old. She wants to know, when is the period? What is it? Where does it come from? And she's got this long list of questions. And her mother is literally crying. She's so traumatized by the fact that her 10-year-old wants to know how anatomy works.
Right.
And then the other thing that happened today was that I was calling around to bookstores. I do book reading sometimes, book events, and it's a free thing for the bookstore or the store that... And I did one up at Brenda's cigar shop up there in Napa, and we had so much fun. We had a bunch of people in, and she sold tons of cigars, and clocks, watches, jewelry, and I sold, you know, sex books about sex and some erotic DVDs. So anyway, I'm calling some bookstores up, and I get a hold of this one proprietor in Auburn. And it was amazing. She goes, well, it depends what the book topic is, whether or not we do book readings. And I said, well, it's a sex manual for women. And she goes, no way. No, and we never do that. I said, so you don't have any books about sex in your bookstore?
Yeah.
She's like, I don't want to have this conversation. She hung up on me. So, you know, and that's in California, Lawrence. That's in California.
I thought California was supposed to be liberal. Aren't Californians known, or California known as the left coast?
Yeah. Yeah. And still we have these pockets of conservatism that is just shocking. It's absolutely shocking to me. And speaking of pockets of conservatism, I know you were going to talk some about sex toys in Texas today.
Well, there's a case that... recently came out of the Fifth Circuit, the appeals court. It's dated February 2008, and the case is called Reliable Consultants versus Ronnie Earle, and it dealt with a Texas statute that criminalized the promotion or sale of sex toys in Texas. And that's probably one of the most recent, if not the most recent, decision that I'm aware of that deals with a substantive due process privacy right around sex. It's a very interesting case.
Now, wasn't this a woman who was trying to do those pleasure parties, you know, where women just basically get together? It's like Tupperware, right? Only instead of buying plastic containers to put, you know, your leftovers in, you buy sex toys to have orgasms by.
Right. Well, in this case, I believe that there was a company, an out-of-state company, that wanted to ship the toys to customers in Texas. The company is called Reliable Consultants, Inc., and it does business as Dreamers and Le Rouge Boutique. And apparently it operates 4 retail stores in Texas. Yeah. So that was the plaintiff in the case. In this particular case, the plaintiff, Reliable Consultants, petitioned the court for a declaratory judgment related specifically to that criminal statute, because obviously Reliable Consultants wanted to sell these sex toys in their stores, and they wanted to do it without getting arrested, I presume. So they petitioned the court for a decision on the constitutionality of that particular criminal law in Texas.
Okay. So it wasn't an individual woman selling sex toys. This must have happened after she went to jail. I do remember hearing about a particular individual woman who got arrested because she owned more than 5 dildos.
Okay. I think that's a different case.
Yeah. Okay. So when did this take place, the case that you're citing?
Well, the court decision came out in February of 2008, and I would guess that the issue came up probably sometime within a couple years prior to that. Usually takes about that long before a case, you know, can work its way up through the appeals process, and an appeals court would issue a decision. So I would guess somewhere around maybe 2005, 2006 is when probably when the case initiated.
Okay, so it's fairly recent history. What was the disposition of that case? What happened?
Well, essentially what the court determined, and this was a federal court, it decided that the particular Texas statute that prohibited the sale or promotion of these sex toys was, in fact, unconstitutional, because it placed an unconstitutional burden on the 14th Amendment under the federal Constitution, the 14th Amendment substantive due process rights, which the court interprets includes privacy rights around intimate, you know, sexual type behaviors in the privacy of your own home.
Do you think this had anything to do with the Supreme Court ruling Lawrence versus Texas of 2003?
Absolutely. The court is citing to Lawrence v. Texas, you know, continuously throughout the entire decision.
Oh, it
and,
did.
Yeah,
oh, that's
it rests very it rests very strongly on Lawrence v. Texas.
That is very exciting. For our listeners who don't know what Lawrence v. Texas is about, can you give us a little brief history?
Sure. Lawrence v. Texas is another case out of Texas. Apparently, Texas has a habit of enacting these repressive laws, so they get challenged. But In Lawrence v. Texas, there was a statute that made criminal sodomy, or between same-sex partners. Obviously, it was a law aimed specifically at gay men, and the court determined in that case, and this is the first time where the Supreme Court made a decision that, in fact, elevated, you know, sexual rights to a level where it was recognized to, in fact, have the status of some sort of right under our Constitution. But the court made the decision that these private sexual behaviors are owed some protection, and basically the legal connection was to the 14th Amendment, and under the substantive due process rights, it's considered a privacy right. The same sorts of rights that led to Roe v. Wade, and it's based on some other previous decisions, but essentially the court determined there that there is a privacy right to intimate sexual behaviors, and that particularly this criminal statute aimed at homosexual intercourse, in fact, unconstitutionally burdened that right, and the court struck down that specific law in Lawrence v. Texas.
Now, for those of us who don't comprehend the 14th Amendment, I myself haven't read it recently, Lawrence.
Right.
can you fill me in on what exactly does the 14th Amendment, what maybe you don't know it verbatim, but if you do, that'd be awesome. If not, at least give me some general idea of what does it cover?
Sure. Actually, I have a copy of the Constitution, fortunately, in my hand.
Of course you do.
Right.
Of course you do. You just finished your finals, didn't you, or something?
Finals? Actually, I've got finals coming up in the next few weeks.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yep. Okay.
You're in study mode. Okay, so you have the Constitution right there?
Sure, right. I'm looking at the 14th Amendment, Section 1, and starting with the second sentence, it says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. But I think the key words there are due process of law. And due process contains two components. One component has to do with process in terms of judicial procedure, ensuring that everyone, if, for example, if you were, charged with some sort of a crime, that you're owed appropriate judicial procedures prior to being convicted of a crime. But that's not the specific aspect that the case is referring to here. The other way of looking at due process is substantive due process. And that's just essentially a kind of a fancy way of saying that it has to do with an important right, a substantial right that's guaranteed in the Constitution. And in this case, what the court puts it under is the what's typically called privacy rights. These privacy rights are something that the court has more recently, just within the last several decades, begun to read into the Constitution, probably beginning with Griswold v. Connecticut in 1965. That was a case that had to do with married couples wishing to obtain contraceptives from their doctor, and at that time there was a law in Connecticut that prohibited it. I believe the law was a criminal law in that case as well, and the court decided there that, in fact, married couples have a privacy right within their marriage around procreation and the right to use contraception. And that was one of the first cases where the court laid out this privacy right around that I would say led to the idea that there's privacy and rights around sexual behavior.
So, there isn't actually a Bill of Rights that directly addresses sex, right?
No. The basic, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution are what are traditionally called the Bill of Rights, and there's nothing in those amendments that says specifically, consenting adults have the right to have sex how they choose within their home. There's nothing that says that. The way the language within the Constitution is written, the founders, they tended to use broad language. And, what that means is it's left to the court and later generations and later decisions to interpret these amendments and apply them to specific situations. So, again, it's only been within the last few decades where the Supreme Court has come out with some decisions where it's kind of defined some rights around this, this idea that adults have the right to have, sex within their own home. Prior to, for example, at the time that Lawrence v. Texas was decided, at that time I believe there were a dozen states that had laws similar to Texas, making it a criminal offense for, basically you know, anal sex. It was a criminal offense. And it's only been since Lawrence v. Texas that the court has clearly delineated or stated that, in fact, adults have some sexual privacy rights.
Now, as you know, I was just out at Yale University, and you had everything to do with getting me out there to speak. I thank you so much for that. It was an amazing experience. Had never been to Yale before.
Great.
But, you know, the dominant theme of my presentation was that we need to have a sexual bill of rights in the United States of America, and that I think it's very disturbing that, you know, our Constitution will protect our right to free speech, you know, assembly, the press, right to worship. You know, the idea that the way I worship is more central to my rights as a, you know, free American than my right to have sex any way I choose, as long as it's adult consensual behavior, it really disturbs me. You know, it's like, yeah, sure, you can go to church wherever you like, but the government will tell you who you can have sex with, why you can have sex with them, when you can have sex with them, and if you can have sex with them. And as somebody who's been in the sex industry for years now, it's just always been such an arbitrary, ridiculous line. So if I was to contract with another adult human being that I would provide sexual services for a given amount of money, that would be an offense that I could go to jail for. If, however, I paid two people to have sex while I was running a camera, all of a sudden it would become a legal business enterprise. So people are still getting paid to have sex. The only difference is that I am not having sex with the people that I'm paying. And this is really convoluted, because if you get to pimping and pandering, if I were to arrange for somebody, you know, like if I was a booking agent and I arranged for somebody to work for a pornographic movie, and I got a percentage, a cut off of that, I would just be an agent working with performers. If, however, that person was not having sex in front of a camera with another actor, but rather going to a hotel room and having sex with maybe a congressman, all of a sudden, it would be a prosecutable offense. So when I look at that, I see a blatant, you know, distinction being made between enterprises which benefit large male-dominated corporations and enterprises which are really usually, you know, small businesses owned by one or two women.
Right.
It's incredibly sexist, first and foremost. And in some ways, I think a case could be made for the sexism in those distinctions between pornography and prostitution. What do you think about my assertion?
Well, I first of all, I think I would agree with everything that you just said there. You know, you started by commenting on the freedom or the right to worship as you choose, which is guaranteed under the First Amendment of the Constitution. And you know, I think that the founders, when they enacted the Bill of Rights, were probably looking more at those rights that had to do with the essential functioning of the democracy. So they guaranteed, for example, freedom of the press. But I think that if you were to talk to just the average Joe, the average man or woman out there, and ask them, you know, what's more important to you, having the right, the unfettered right to read whatever news reports you wish, or the right to have intimate relations with your loved one in the privacy of your own home in the way that you wish without government intrusion. What's more important to you in terms of the quality of your life? My guess is that the average person would say, the government has no business putting its nose in my bedroom, in our private, you know, in my private sex life. The government has no business doing that. So I think that the probably to the average person, that right is probably more important than, you know, some of those other rights, for example, in the First Amendment. That's just my opinion. But, for example, getting back to Lawrence v. Texas, the court does state, in the preamble leading up to, you know, the central holdings of the decision that, in fact, there's a growing consensus that private, sexual behavior is something that, you know, is within a sphere that the government doesn't belong in.
Well, and you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who really, you know, make the connection between freedom of information and our ability to be a democracy, because obviously in countries where they suppress information, that's where you're able to have a great deal of control over the citizens. However, this right to worship as you please, I don't want to denigrate that at all, because I personally have a spiritual life that's very important to me, and I don't want the government getting involved in that.
Absolutely.
However, given the fact that a lot of people don't even go to church nowadays, but almost everybody has sex of some kind, it does
right.
seem to me that a sexual bill of rights would have a lot more relevance in our modern society than the right to worship. And not that we have to pit these against each other. I think the only reason you and I are taking this approach is to try to highlight how incredibly absurd it is that we don't have the right to be sexual beings, that the government can take that away from us whenever it chooses. And it does, you know, by saying that you can't have, you know, sex if you're homosexual, which, you know, I mean, can you imagine 2003 before we get a Supreme Court ruling that says, yes, you can?
Right.
Like, wow.
Right.
Yeah. And then as far as selling sex, it is, you know, that's a big leap for a lot of people. A lot of people have some extreme moral judgments against that. But, you know, just like you heard me say at Yale, I think as long as there is any group of people who it's okay to limit their ability to be sexual, to put them in jail for sex, then you're kind of sending a message to the entire population that you better not step out of line.
I agree with you. You know, you made a statement, as I recall, during your presentation at Yale, to the effect that the government could make any law it wants limiting our sexual behavior at any time. Now, I don't think that's true following Lawrence v. Texas, but we still have, certainly, I think we have a long way to go. Actually, I have a question. I think this is something that's still open and undecided, but for example, Lawrence v. Texas was aimed at a statute that was specifically, targeted, you know, same-sex activity. But,
right.
It overturned a prior decision that upheld a law in Georgia that criminalized, you know, the same act, you know, legally the term is sodomy, but in Georgia, in the Bowers decision, the court upheld that criminal act. However, that particular law was aimed at everyone, you know, both heterosexuals and homosexuals. So that's actually a distinction. And I'm not sure if following Lawrence v. Texas, if in fact a law that, you know, criminalized, again, using the legal term sodomy, didn't target just same-sex couples, would in fact be considered unconstitutional. That's actually a question that I'm not completely clear about, and I'm not sure that Lawrence v. Texas clearly resolved that issue.
Well, you know, as a sex educator, I am privy to the fact that anal sex has actually become very popular with heterosexual couples in their 20s.
Sure.
Whereas anal sex used to be something that people might do after they'd been dating for a while. It was considered, you know, something kind of special, like very taboo. I got to know you pretty well before I let you go there. Now it's kind of considered like, well, we'll do that before we actually have vaginal sex.
Right.
So that would be interesting to find out that in fact, one of the very popular forms of sexual expression right now in the younger set is, perhaps, illegal on a, would you say federal basis? Or was that a law that was universal for the entire country or just a particular state?
Well, these criminal laws are typically state laws, and they're considered unconstitutional when they burden a federal right that's guaranteed in the Constitution. The state has to have at least the level of protection of our liberties that the federal Constitution guarantees. But these criminal laws are all state laws, so it varies state by state. If I'm not mistaken, I think there are probably a few states as we speak that may have laws against oral sex as well.
Yes, definitely.
As you just explained, among large portions of the population, these types of sexual activities, anal sex and oral sex, they're very common. They're normal, and the fact that they're criminal is. It just demonstrates how, in fact, the law typically follows social developments, but it doesn't lead social developments. It usually inhibits.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The law is like kind of the last to know.
Yeah.
And I think that what gives the law so much power over people's sexuality at this point is the namesake of this entire radio program, which is called the Shame Free Zone. It's people's sexual shame that allows them to kind of bow their head and take whatever they think they've got coming. So, if their rights are abridged, it's very difficult for people to stand up and say, actually, you don't have the moral right and you should not have the legal right to treat me that way, just because you don't happen to like the way or the position in which I choose to have sex or the people I choose to have sex with or the reasons I choose to have sex. It's none of your business. I think it's really hard for people to go there because, just in some ways it goes back to what I was watching on Oprah today where these women are so afraid to talk to their kids. They're really communicating to their children that sex is wrong. It's taboo. We're afraid to talk about it. You just asking your mother about your period can send her off in a flurry of tears. So if that's your introduction to sex, then it's kind of, that's spread from generation to generation. We should be embarrassed. We should be ashamed. If the government comes along and says, you should be embarrassed and you should be ashamed, you're like, oh, yeah, you're right.
Right.
Who am I to argue with the sexual shame, I mean, it takes, it is not the majority of people who are bucking that and saying no to it.
Well,
even though we have a culture that is supposedly saturated with sexual images, which, by the way, I personally don't see that they're very sexual. I see that they use nudity and sexually graphic images to promote violence. Because there's a lot of hateful stuff going on there. But, that notwithstanding, sexual freedom is not what's being promoted.
Well, certainly not. I don't think that the law or the government in any way supports, is a leader in the area of sexual freedom. I think it takes effort. It takes, determination to buck the system and to stand up and challenge these laws. It takes someone who's very, who has some strong beliefs and are very determined and willing to, pay a certain price. And, not everyone, I think, is cut out for that. But the good work of people like yourself and, Maxine Dugan in San Francisco, that helps. So,
thank you.
Sure.
Well, I think the impetus for me was just growing up in a right-wing Christian religious family that was hypocritical as the day is long.
So right.
They were sexually abusing their children, but they would never cheat on their wives,
So apparently you saw that, for what it is and was able to shed those shackles and the guilt or what shame, whatever you felt. My guess is a lot of people can't do that.
No, I can't say that most of my family of origin did make that journey. Most of them are, I mean, it was like my mother, I was asking her to go over. I wanted her to see my new website, sexwithoutshame.com. I was so proud of it, and I'd really gone to great lengths to make sure it didn't have any erotic images on it, certainly nothing pornographic, because, you know, if I'm going to have a website called Sex Without Shame, it needs to be modeling a lot of sexual shame. You know, that's a joke, Lawrence. But it really is, because, you know, obviously if people are suffering from sexual shame, then they don't want to be accosted with images and concepts that are too jarring or shocking for them. So I try to make it as friendly and innocuous as possible.
Right. You don't want them to feel shame as soon as they log on to your website.
Exactly. Exactly. So I thought, well, this would be very easy for my mother. My mother would finally be able to go to one of my websites. But I didn't realize that having the word sex in the URL was a deal breaker for her.
Right.
So she was like, no, I'm not going to go look at it. I go, Mother, there's no images. It's just me in a suit. It's a headshot. It's all words. And,
right.
You know, it's very intelligent and tasteful and G-rated. I promise you, it's very G-rated. And she's like, well, okay, I'll go look at it, but yeah, I just want you to know something. I don't even say that word. And it's like, what word? And it's going, sex? Oh, my God. Have I gotten so out of touch with my family of origin that I don't know that my own mother can't say the word sex? So those are the people I come from. And, you know, if they had just been puritanical, I suppose I probably would have fallen right in line with their values and their morals. But because of the hypocrisy, which I found so unacceptable and so distasteful, it gave me permission to make a full break and really, you know, go explore things on my own and see what I think. Find out what I think.
Well, you know, the psychological and cultural issues are a little out of my area of expertise, but, I think things that you're saying make a lot of sense.
Well, I understand that, but you know what you can comment on is, you know, how you personally perceive the presentation, what other students shared with you, and in particular, you know, I'm just wondering, do you think the idea of, you know, a sexual bill of rights took hold at Yale? Do you think people were, you know, I don't know, enlivened or enthused about the concept, or was the general consensus, yeah, that'd be nice on another planet, but it'll never happen here?
Well, the feedback that I got from students that, you know, essentially just approached me in the hallways and so forth immediately after the seminar was that they were very supportive. I was really surprised and impressed by the positive feedback that I received from students. I think really that what we did there in some ways was enlightening to a lot of students, because I think often the discussion and debate is very controlled by, you know, conformists or those who want to, you know, uphold the status quo, particularly around, you know, prostitution laws. And so there's a lot of argument and discussion about why these laws are justified, how they're important, and just the fact that we got up there and presented another perspective was something that was really eye-opening to a lot of students. And the students that I spoke to were very impressed and very supportive, and that was the feedback that I got.
That's really exciting. What do you think the main, you know, I understand, like, you know, from my mother's generation, I understand some of the arguments against prostitution are like, a woman shouldn't degrade herself, she should try to save her virginity for her husband, and then, you know, as television audiences have told me, after I shot down every single argument they had against prostitution, they'd finally just throw up their hands in, you know, frustration and say, well, we just know it's wrong. But I'm wondering what the 20-something student, what argument against prostitution would cause them to support laws against prostitution?
Well, my guess is that probably the strongest argument or most common argument against prostitution is probably a moral argument, just as you just stated, that, you know, I just know it's wrong. But I'm not sure that holds water with a lot of the younger people today who perhaps have a, you know, more open mind on, you know, around many of these, you know, sexual type issues, and certainly not with people who, such as myself, who have more of a libertarian type perspective, you know, around our individual rights. In fact, in Lawrence v. Texas, I believe that the court quoted a statement made by one of the justices in, it was a dissent, right, I'm sorry, it was Justice Stevens, who dissented in Bowers. That was the decision that Lawrence v. Justice overturned, and in his dissent, Stevens said, the fact that the governing majority in a state has traditionally viewed a particular practice as immoral is not a sufficient reason for upholding a law prohibiting the practice. I would certainly agree with that. I think that when the right is very important, maybe it doesn't have to be to the level of what's considered a fundamental right, but just an important right. Just the fact that the majority of the population around you may not agree or like the practice, that's not a strong enough reason to, you know, criminalize or make illegal an act that, you know, some individuals within the realm of their conscience of what they feel is right in their private lives, that act can be criminalized.
Well, I absolutely. Hold on a second. I'm going to check in with our listeners here, and just to remind you guys, this is live. If you've got any questions for Lawrence Cohen, he's a law student and obviously very well versed in legal precedents surrounding sexual rights. You can call us in toll free at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. If you prefer the internet, I'm on Twitter right now. Twitter.com/Veronica Monet. Just look for Veronica Monet on Twitter and send me a question, a comment, whatever you feel moved to share. So Lawrence, there were two dissenting judges on Lawrence versus Texas, weren't there?
I think so. Probably, I believe it was Scalia and Thomas.
Yes, and at least one of them, I can't remember which, their reason for dissenting was because they felt that it was a slippery slope towards legalizing prostitution.
I agree. I did not read the dissent as closely, but I think that was probably the reason. And I know that Scalia and Thomas tend to be very much traditionalists in that they tend to look at, you know, the Bill of Rights and the language of the Constitution from the standpoint of, well, what would the founders have said about this issue? But I think that you know, my response or those who tend to believe that the Constitution is a document that can be responsive to our changing times in society, you know, I think that my response to that would be, well, the founders, I think, intentionally wrote the Constitution using language that was very broad because they knew that, in fact, they would not be able to foresee every situation that might come up that would relate to, you know, some of these broad rights that they're delineating, and they intentionally used very broad language with the understanding that future courts and future generations would be able to interpret this language and apply it to, you know, these changing situations. So you know, I don't know. I kind of think this idea of going back to, well, what would the founders have thought about gay sex is kind of awkward, and it's just not responsive to the fact that, you know, our culture is substantially different. Our lifestyles are substantially different than what they were, you know, 250 years ago.
Yes, however, one of the things that children have a propensity to do is try to imagine that their parents are not sexual.
Sure.
And you know, and then their grandparents, they don't even want to hear about that. They call our
right.
grandparents don't have sex. I'm not sure my parents did. I guess they did just on the night I was conceived. And just as a group, I mean, as, you know, we're all children of somebody. And it's interesting to me how here we are, full-grown adults, and we act as if we invented sex. But everything that human beings do in the bedroom today has been going on since there were human beings, period. Going on before there were human beings. You know, I love talking about bonobos because they do have every type of sex known to man. Now, they don't actually have anal sex, but they've got fellatio, cunnilingus, you know, missionary style, doggy style, heterosexual, bisexual, homosexual, lesbian, every kind of sex that we humans think, oh, somehow or another we have the corner on the market, we invented this stuff. They even French kiss. So obviously tongue kissing is not French. The idea that somehow or another the founding fathers of this country were not having all those different types of sex is just ludicrous. It's childish. And I hope at some point the American citizens can stop acting like children. But here's the thing about suppressing people's sexuality. You rather force them to stay childlike. And that is the purpose. This is the same thing that a lot of pack animals, you know, animals that live in packs like wolves, will suppress the sexuality of many of its members so that there will only be two leaders. Because when you have a fully sexual being, you've got a fully mature being, which means they're very powerful. And it is easier to have a nation full of children who are not sexually matured, who have silly ideas about sex that keep them under the thumb of the religion or the government, whoever it is that wants to be in power. But if you'll notice, the men who are in power in our government and our corporations and even in our religions don't curb their sexual appetites at all.
That would appear to be the case. Right. If Governor Spitzer or Senator Ritter or you know, many of the others, CEOs who you may be more familiar with than I am, would probably tend to support that statement.
Well, it's like sex is kept off in a corner somewhere for just the wealthy, rich people who are in charge of everything, because we don't want the commoners to have sex.
Sure.
So. And you know, it's funny, I'm not a fan of Larry Flint, the editor of Hustler magazine. I'm not even a fan of Hustler magazine. But I do think that it's quite interesting what he said when he said, well, the poor man's porn is called, you know, pornography, smut, it's linked to crime. You know, people say it's degrading and demoralizing society, but the rich man's porn they call erotica.
Right. Did Larry Flint say that?
Larry Flint talked. Yeah, he. I'm paraphrasing him.
I don't think he was quite as eloquent.
But you know, he caught a lot of flack for his magazine because he was targeting the working man. He wasn't targeting, you know, the rich jet-setting man.
Right.
Like, you know, Hugh Hefner, who was definitely appealing to guys that wanted to be kind of like James Bond, you know?
Right.
And Larry Flint was talking to mechanics and plumbers.
Right. Well, you know, I think that we know that the well-to-do tend to have a disproportionate influence with our politicians, and perhaps that has something to do with many of these very repressive laws. Perhaps
well,
they saying it has something to do with, you know, maintaining the current class structure, the status quo.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely think that it does. And that's why I'm hoping people will start, you know, stop getting caught up in the little minutiae. It's like if we're busy going, well, okay, yeah, I don't want the government making heterosexual married sex their business, but I think they should definitely crack down on gays. Or like, no way, they shouldn't have anything to say about gay sex. That's none of their business. Gay people, I have lots of gay friends, and I don't want them going to jail. But those prostitutes, though, that's another thing. As long as we've got, like, some subset of society that we think it's okay to throw in jail because they didn't hurt anybody.
Right.
And that's what we're really talking about here. We are talking about putting people in jail, our overcrowded, stressed out, overtaxed legal system judicial system and the jails and the penitentiaries, which apparently cannot hold the pedophiles and the rapists and the serial killers, and we don't even have enough cops to go after all those people, but we got time to put people who are having, you know, so-called sodomy,
right,
or exchanging cash for sex. We have time to put those people in jail. And I don't get it how that's even a good allocation of our resources. A city like San Francisco, California, spends like $11 million a year arresting prostitutes, and they don't even curb prostitution. It just becomes a legal way for the police department to exact a tax.
Right.
That's really what it boils down to, because they usually arrest the same prostitutes over and over again. And they put them in the system. They flirt with them. They might have sex with them. We actually have lots of documented cases of cops exchanging sex with prostitutes in agreement not to arrest them. And I was sitting in the jail cell myself, having been arrested for prostitution, got to watch all the blatant flirting that was going on between the police officers and the street prostitutes. It made me sick. It absolutely made me sick.
Well,
and these women are through that system so often that they know all those cops by name. They probably had sex with quite a few of them. It was obvious that they had a very sexually inappropriate relationship with them, even if actual sex had not transpired. And I felt sexually harassed when I got arrested. They had me walk down. I had to walk past about six police officers who were all lined up against a wall and making cat calls as I walked by.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I've been on the train like you'd love to get your hands on a case like that, huh?
Sure. That sounds like a case that might be fun to bring to trial.
Unfortunately, the problem is, you know, it's my word against theirs, and they're all upstanding citizens, and I'm just a hoe.
Police misconduct. But, no, I agree. I think that brings to light the fact that, you know, you really have to question about the allocation of the resources, you know, arresting consenting adults when certainly there are crimes that are much more serious and harm people much worse than consenting sex. There's I don't really see the harm to the individual in that type of activity. But from a philosophical perspective, I think it brings us to the question of, you know, what is the role of the police, and what is the role of government, and what sorts of behaviors should be protected, and what sorts should be criminalized. And from a libertarian type perspective, you know, I think the argument would be that only those behaviors that directly harm another individual, you know, behaviors that are not consensual, are the sorts of behaviors that should be criminalized. Whereas certainly consensual sex, I don't think that's an area that the government, it's a wise use of resources of our police or money or our laws or anything else to try to enforce these type of criminal prohibitions. They're very difficult for law enforcement to enforce, and they tend to be violated a lot, from what I understand, and not enforced very effectively either.
And of course, from my standpoint, you know, I will go one step further and say that I actually believe that one of the reasons the United States of America has one in 100 people in prison, one of the reasons that America has one of the highest murder rates and the highest rate of violence in the world is because we are also one of the most sexually puritanical cultures on the planet. Now, with the exception, of course, of some, not all, some Islamic countries who still practice the, what do they call that, Sharia laws.
Yes.
I just saw something where they were flogging a 17-year-old girl because they thought she had an inappropriate sexual relationship with somebody. And I don't think sexual, I think it was flirtation, like she dated the wrong guy. And then, of course, you know, the so-called honor killings, where a man defends his honor by murdering a young girl who is supposed to have had inappropriate, quote-unquote, sex. That I see a pattern here, which I find incredibly disturbing, that if your culture embraces the idea that it's okay to imprison and or punish and or torture and or kill people because of their sexual behavior, that your culture is probably also excessively violent in a lot of other ways.
That's a very interesting hypothesis. I think there may be some truth to that. I think that would make a great research study.
Yeah, I was thinking about going back to school. I think you inspired me, Lawrence, by bringing my butt out to Yale University. I'm like, I miss school.
Right, that could be a PhD dissertation.
Absolutely. I was thinking even I'd be able to use it as an excuse to, I have to go out to Atlanta, Georgia, and meet the bonobos at the research center myself, the same ones that Peter Gabriel went out and cut an album with.
Right.
He was so impressed with the bonobos, he bought them laptops and cell phones.
Right.
So you never know. Never know. I'm not entirely sure how I would set that one up. But certainly, we do have evidence that where there is sexual repression, there is violence. And there's actually some communities in Mexico where they've done some parallel studies. So the community of San Carlos is sitting right next to the community of La Paz. La Paz is more sexually liberal and therefore has less violence, and San Carlos is more sexually possessive and repressive, and they have more violence.
Well, you know, a few weeks ago I was watching television, one of the morning news shows, and what the news lady had a couple doctors on the show, and they were talking about a recent study that demonstrated that men who have sex regularly, I believe they said three times a week, they compared these men with men who had sex once a month and found that those who had regular sexual activity were much healthier. These were doctors that were speaking, and I would assume that this would relate to both mental as well as physical health. And so yes, I think that, you know, perhaps having a sexual outlet would be is probably essential for our health. And in fact, I think that lends itself to the argument that, you know, this private, intimate sexual behavior should be considered a fundamental right and should be protected. And perhaps that would lend itself, bring it back to the prostitution debate, the idea that I know that many prostitutes would perhaps promote themselves not just as entertainers, but as perhaps as sex therapists. And there are probably many individuals out there who really, for mental, and you might be able to be categorized as a medical need the access to these type services. And that
I would absolutely. I would love to see this for disabled people,
right.
People who are in hospitals and maybe close to dying. You know, I've worked with
right.
clients who are disabled and clients who were terminal, and I'm telling you, to be a fully sexual being with your last breath on this planet is so
right.
important.
And right, exactly.
So important.
And this type of argument, I think, would make a very strong argument for the decriminalization of prostitution.
You know, We're out of time. I'm going to let you have the last say there. You summed everything up very nicely. Thank you, Lawrence. It's been a lot of fun to have you on the show.
Great. Well, I always enjoy speaking with you, Veronica.
Same here, Lawrence. I hope you come back. And who knows, maybe you and I will draft the next piece of legislation.
Excellent.
I'll go to school. You get your law degree. Let's see what happens.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much. And hope to see you out on the East Coast sometime soon.
Great.
Okay.
See you soon.
Take care, Lawrence.
You too.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you.
At the end.